You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and I host the Orthodox Nationalist broadcast here on Radio Albion, dealing with all aspects of political ethno-nationalism and its relationship to the Orthodox Church. This is being recorded in the evening of the 19th of October, 2024. Now, what I want to do here is because I went so fast last week in part one of this talk on the Cossacks within the Polish Empire, I skipped over a whole bunch of things, or I treated them in a very cursory way. So today, I want to finish this up clarifying some of the points I made last week. Now, these historical events helped create the Talmudic Jewish mentality, introducing it to Europe. It created the seeds of a much later Polish national movement, since these revolts and revolutions will see Poland eventually fall apart. And most certainly, the very core of any Ukrainian identity. The full title, when and if I publish this, is called After 1648, The Nature of Cossack Political Ideology and Class Conflict During the Ruin. The Ruin is a specific period of time where there were many leaders all hating each other, pure chaos on both banks of the Dnieper. Let me summarize this very briefly. 1648, the uprising of Bogdan Khmelnytsky against the Poles and the Jews, didn't turn out the way they had planned. But very quickly after that uprising, two factions developed. One leaned to the Polish side of things, and the other to the Russian side of things. The Russian side is what we call the eastern or left bank of the Dnieper, and the pro-Polish generally is on the right bank of that same river. And this division is absolutely essential in understanding the politics of the day. The divisions usually had two completely different societies on both sides of the river, or on either side of the river. And Ukraine was unified only once, roughly, in this period of time. And that was under Turkish domination, under the Hetman Doroshenko. The Polish side saw its intellectual apogee in the Treaty of Hadyacz. And the Treaty of Pereslav was emblematic of the pro-Russian side. Ukraine wasn't unified, in other words, both banks of the Dnieper, because during and after the ruin, the stability was imposed by a joint Russo-Polish partition of the country. So the main result of the uprising of Khmelnytsky was in 1654, and that's the Treaty of Pereslav. And the only way that that could have been signed, this was signed with Moscow, was if there were firm ground to see Ukraine as a distinct nation, with a Cossack core, meaning that the Uniates, so-called Greek Catholics, and the Jews were excluded from it. I mean, obviously Roman Catholics were too. This is where the Ukrainian idea germinates. It was in the Orthodox and Cossack battle against Polish Catholics where Ukraine and Orthodoxy were synonymous and became a single thing. And nations get their marks of distinction from the faith. A unient, so-called Greek Catholic, often not realizing that they're under the Pope of Rome, is not Ukrainian, especially not at the time, because a follower of it was seen as somewhat of a Polish partisan. In the 18th century, that would change a little bit, especially in Galicia. The fact that today the Uniates in Western Ukraine style itself the core of the national movement, the anti-Russian and pro-liberal national movement, is a little strange because it was set up to serve two foreign powers, the Vatican, chief among them, and to a lesser extent, Poland. The Polish oligarchy wanted to Latinize Ukraine. The Vatican was a little bit more, and the Jesuit order was a little bit more moderate in that respect. The Unia was never accepted by Orthodoxy at any point. It doesn't make a lot of sense. You can't have the Eastern liturgy in its fullness, which contains theology and ideas at one point anathematized by the Church of Rome. It doesn't make sense, and it was meant to be temporary. Now, as I said last week, and I've said many times before, Poland was a strange kind of empire because ultimately it was a federation of medium to very large noble estates, each having its own customary law and even its own court system, financial policy. There was no state center. Of course, that'll be changed after World War I. The Szlachta is the collective oligarchy, the collective nobility. Saw the nation as themselves. Peasants, Jews, the Orthodox, and others were never a part of this. Now, Cossack uprisings against both Polish and Jewish rule began the end of the 16th century, but came into their own in the 1620s and 1630s. And the problems were increased by the level of extreme violent reprisals. I mean, it got so bad that the Polish Sejm, that is to say the Senate, the noble legislature, not trusting anything under royal control, hired Muslim mercenaries to fight the Cossacks. The 1652 invasion of that hired army would have destroyed the country had not the Russians intervened. Now, as I said last week, the Khmelnytsky uprising has been the subject of thousands of books and articles. And I can't do any of that justice here. Suffice it to say that this combination of religious repression, intensifying serfdom, almost to the point of slavery, and certainly usury, and Jewish alien control of the cities, created an alienated, suffering, and very angry Slavic Orthodox national movement that, prior to 1648, only required a talented leader. Again, the results were not quite what was planned, and it caused as much harm as good. But the good part was in building this Central European Ukrainian Orthodox ethnicity. Khmelnytsky, especially his early victories against the Poles, temporarily broke their usury and parasitism, at least for a time, and built what today we know as the Cossack state, or the Hetmanate, taken for the most part, but not unanimously, as the very essence of Ukraine. After his death in 1657, the state began to dissolve. And as the Poles began to reassert themselves, occasionally with Russian help, the Hetmanate, now divided between the two banks, became leaderless. So the result was factionalism, bribery, the manipulation of foreign powers, and the complete destruction of trust. Because the Cossack host itself was never strong enough to take on a major empire by itself, it always needed allies. But allies never come free. So, of course, the issue was to find someone strong enough to assist, but far enough away that they really can't reach Ukraine very well. And under Mazepa, much later than what we're talking about now, that was Sweden. But usually it was either pro-Russian or pro-Polish, and there are a few exceptions, which we'll talk about here in a little bit. This was the template for the Ukrainian Orthodox ethno-national ideal to this day, or at least prior to the Orange Revolution. This is a monstrous parody of nationalism. And its primary theoretical postulate was that ethnic belonging, that is to say, the language and the faith, form the boundaries of political units, not lines on a map. To some extent, Cossack intellectuals wanted to imitate institutionally Kiev and Rus in the Russian Middle Ages. Given the reality of their situation and where they're located geographically, there is always the constant threat of a multi-front war, meaning that at a minimum, the hetman, or the elected war leader of the Cossacks, had to be an authoritarian and centralized office, mirrored, of course, by the strong officer corps in a very strict, well-defined hierarchical relationship with the hetman. The big problem, of course, is that that meant that high-ranking Cossack officers could be bought off fairly easily. In other words, they could behave no different than any other noble order and end up the primary enemy of the centralization that they needed to function. Legal centralization needed its parallel within the church. The church, the Orthodox Church, was free. But since so much of the oppression of the Polish oligarchy was religious, it was essential that the church, intellectually speaking, spiritually speaking, be able to fight both the Catholic and the Jewish mentality, and a little bit later, the Protestants. As I said last week, in great detail, the close alliance between the Polish elite and the Jews was such as to make them a single unit of financial exploitation. Now, the Slotcha, the nobility, needed Jewish credit networks, Jewish capital, and their exclusive focus on urban trade. In order for them to function, the reverse was not true. The Polish nobility was convenient for a while, but the oligarchs' indolence and general absurdity made them, I think I said this last week, an unstable golem for the network's profits. But the main emphasis, the establishment of a Cossack state on communitarian virtues that went way beyond just protests against serfdom and usury, that motivated almost all Cossack rebellions, the dozens that occurred. Khmelnytsky was a royalist. The hetmanate was a royal position, but the state that he oversaw wasn't strong enough, especially given the constant concern with the steppe and Ukrainian fertile territory that other empires wanted to take. Of course, the Cossack hetmanate was not an empire, so alliances were absolutely necessary. Now, there was one Russian writer who said that the Cossacks could never, at this period of time, could never be seen as a state, and he gives 8 reasons for this. Number one, there was no defined territory. In other words, borders on a map weren't agreed by everybody. Number two, there was no definite population. They just came and went, new ones came, and there's really no concept of a permanent citizenship. The third was that there was neither civil law nor criminal law that stretched through the entire hetmanate. The fourth, there was no specific duties towards the state, and of all the falsities here, 4 is one of the worst. There were no taxes or duties, number 5. Number 6, he claims that there's no state institutions, including number 7, the treasury, and finally, that there wasn't a national church or churches under Cossack control at all. So this guy's making the argument that each Cossack made a living for himself and himself alone. Of course, most of these are false. and understand what he's assuming here. He's defining a state as a specifically modern state based on written protocols and laws. Of course, all of these problems, not all of them, but they could be a challenge to the Poles as well, given the circumstances. But a state and a nation, of course, are two different things. The Cossacks certainly were a nation, or at least represented one. We'll talk about the organization of their church structure here in a little bit, but the Cossacks were never a modern movement. Now let's go back a little bit to the origin of at least the concept of the Cossack that we recognize today. The Cossack uprisings were very common, starting roughly in the revolt of 1591 to the end of Cossack independence upon the defeat of Pugachev in 1775. 1591 was the Kozinski Revolt, and it was based, although there was no clear agenda, it was based on the rapidly developing class distinctions being made between Cossack warriors and the elite. Clearly, class played a huge role in all of this, both domestically and in terms of their foreign affairs. But this revolt was the first widespread rebellion against the expansion of the Polish oligarchy. Rebellion among the Cossacks was nothing new. It was a normal state of affairs, and it was the only means whereby the Orthodox could be protected. The creation of the unions, the Greek Catholics, was a huge provocation. Remember, this came into existence in 1595, and that's, you know, other than Kozinski in 1591, many of the, if not all, of the subsequent Cossack uprisings, like Novalko and many others, made the abolition of the Unia a key plank. As I mentioned, the Polish confederations, which were temporary noble military institutions in Poland, usually short-lived, but they were very violent, and their punitive raids after a Cossack rebellion were nasty. So I mentioned the writer who talks about the lack of a Cossack state in the modern sense. There certainly was no state in Poland either. The confederations were the most powerful entities in Polish noble politics. I think I also mentioned the concept of the registry last week. This is something I needed to expand on. The registry was quite literally a list of names, family, of course, and being on this list conferred nobility. It was a creation of the Polish oligarchy in the late 16th century, and it offered, as being a member of the noble class, freedoms and immunities not available to anyone else. Among other things, the freedom from monetary taxation. Being on the register made it difficult to prosecute, just like any noble order, because the entire order needed to be consulted as to guilt or to be sentenced. The worst part, though, is once a Cossack was removed from the registry, he became, officially and unofficially, a peasant, and hence subject to being made a serf. Now, the registry was the cause of the second major rebellion, Novalka, and then the revolt of Ivan Bolotnikov, connected with the time of troubles in Russia. And there were many others over the years. The Zamalo Revolt of 1625, also over the registry. Early revolts had maybe between 2,000 and 3,000 men. Novalko and even Kozinski saw rebel forces numbering anywhere from 12,000 to 25,000. The Fyodorovich Rebellion in 1630 was the first one with a very clear agenda. The first one against the Unia, and the first one explicitly condemning Jewish financial practices. Now, the perfidy of the Kahal, Jewish finance, was admitted by everybody. So the facts of the matter can't be disputed, which makes tenured academics very uncomfortable when dealing with it. But as is so often the case, the Jews who were brought in by the oligarchs in Poland to dominate the trade of the cities and hence finance their total lack of real purpose outside of occasional military service, they pushed way too hard, and they overestimated the ability of the Polish nobility to protect them. Now, the Fedorowicz uprising was very small, I don't know, 1,500 men. But even a small one like this, especially where the Cossacks were concerned, would bring the oligarchy into a near state of panic. 1638, the Hunia revolt was against the obnoxious practice of making serfs out of formerly registered Cossacks. You imagine going from a member of a knightly order to a peasant with a serf-based relationship with a lord. As the population in the Western world grew and the demand for wheat went up, Polish nobles, and certainly their Jewish intermediaries, looking at the Baltic Sea as an outlet, needed to press their peasants harder and harder over time. Remember, the Polish oligarchy claimed to be the descendants, not literal descendants, but of the true Republican mentality. Of course, that wasn't true, although it is my opinion that republics are oligarchies. But other than that, it was very difficult to make the argument that the Cossacks didn't have a just cause. Problems being, though, organization, leadership, and the ability of the Poles to buy off certain elements of the upper ranks of the Cossacks, hence keeping them divided. But to say that the whole host or the whole people rose up in certain cases is not an exaggeration. As I mentioned last week, the Cossacks can refer to two separate things. The first is the Zaporozhian Sich, fortress beyond the rapids in Dnieper. They were the most radical, living in very inaccessible areas within a stockade that raided, especially to save Orthodox people from both serfdom and slavery. And the second was the Hetmanate, the Little Russian Cossack force, not necessarily connected to, sometimes even in opposition to, the Zaporozhian. But Zaporozhian, you know, and sometimes people would use the two synonymously. Zaporozhian was a more specialized, tightly bound, but smaller group. But the Sich, as inaccessible as it is, became the core of all of these revolts. So this was a stubborn war. The Polish confederations, the Polish elite, with their Jewish intermediaries, wanted to Polonize and Catholicize Western Rus. And that's where the Sich became of immense significance. The Patriarch of Jerusalem, we'll talk about him in a minute, Theophanes III, ennobled them himself. But the Jews were brought into Polish cities roughly at the end of the 14th century at the latest. That was the annexation of certain Lithuanian lands to Poland, and that's roughly where the Cossacks began to grow. Serfdom was introduced in the 15th century for reasons I've already mentioned. One of the first mentions of the Cossacks says that they participated in a campaign with the Poles against the Teutonic Order in 1410. And it was in 1540 that Sigismund of Poland granted them lands that eventually became the Sich, the Dnieper Rapids. Oh, they moved farther south, and they fortified, that actually, and very specifically, beyond the rapids means the island of Kuritsa, which is where the actual stockade was. Zaporozhians were founded in 1550, explicitly. After the Union of Lublin in 1569, which brought Poland and Lithuania within one commonwealth, serfdom began to grow, And that's when you had more refugees coming to live among the Cossacks, runaway serfs, in other words. When the, at least partly Russian-speaking, Lithuanian principality was absorbed by Poland, absorbed is too strong, but part of the Commonwealth, that radically changed everything, because now Poland was an empire. In Lithuania, Russian law was replaced by the German, Polish-German. Russian language was expelled from state institutions, and the Orthodox Church, which was independent there in Lithuania, was persecuted. And as the years went by, more and more Russian speakers and Orthodox left the Commonwealth. And many of them, by the way, became some of the more powerful noble families in Russia. We're talking about these boundless steppes or prairies along the Bug, the Dniester, Dnieper rivers. They were quickly populated by Russians from Poland, Lithuania, even Galicia, that fled from economic oppression. And wherever the magnates, the oligarchs in Poland moved, they brought their serfs with them. And if they did well in a campaign, they were given legal title to more lands. That just meant that the fugitives fled even farther south. A lot of people weren't complaining too loudly about it, whether it be in Russia or in Poland, because the Cossacks ended up becoming an outpost against the raids of the Tartars and Turks. But the Polish oligarchy was immature and brutal, and they will eventually push the early Cossacks into war against themselves. So runaway serfs were a huge part of the recruits for the Cossack order. And there were three things, three scourges, as it used to be called. The Polish oligarch, that's number one. Number two, the Latin missionary, that is to say, the Jesuits, usually. And the third, I've already mentioned, the Jewish manager. There's not a lot of historical examples where explicitly bringing in large numbers of Jews to run the city so that the crown could not take that money and that they could then do whatever they want while the Jews do all the work. Of course, they were laughably indebted. As I mentioned before, the oligarchs needed the Jews. The Jews didn't need the oligarchs. It was a temporary expedient. But the Jewish manager held the lease, in fact, if not necessarily in law, held the lease to his estate, fishing, hunting rights, roads and taverns, and churches. As I mentioned last week, the Orthodox peasant couldn't marry or baptize or even be buried without the permission of the local Jew. And I got that from there was a French representative at the court of Catherine II in 1786 who wrote the Chronicles of Little Rus, which was published in Paris. And he goes into some detail in that respect. The Russian peasant, that is to say the Ukrainian or Rus peasant, was in the power of the Jewish leaseholders from the day of his birth to the day of his death. And of course, they ran with these rights. And they paid the Polish magnates for this privilege. This really is what the Zaporozhian Cossack force was all about. They were usually joined by the Little Russian Cossacks or their hetmanate, who rose up for many reasons, but the most important was the defending Orthodoxy, fighting the Uniates, but this oligarchic Jewish connection within the Polish Empire was the real reason for the irrationality in many of the policies. The monarch had very little power. The monarch tended to be very sympathetic to the Cossacks. In fact, the Szlachta was always at war with their own monarch. And they kept, amongst the Rus, the Ruthenians, bishops from ever taking their sees. The Zaporozhian hetman Sydaczny was the man who restored the Orthodox hierarchy in 1620 through Theophan III of Jerusalem, who was returning from a trip to Moscow. Much of what in the 20th century was the Polish hierarchy derives from this consecration. Maybe not that far. I don't want to overstate it. But this was the canonical foundation the consecrations of Theophan III of Jerusalem. Constantinople was way too much of a problem at the time in 1620. And they appealed to the Cossacks to defend the Orthodox Church against the both the Jews and the Poles. There's something of the chronicle from Warsaw's pacification of 1637 goes into some detail. This is a Polish source about the various tortures used for Cossacks and rebel peasants. The author is impressed at the level of creativity. Nothing could shake them. And for these people, it wasn't so much serfdom. Those who survived were enslaved. And of course, the churches were never spared. Everything that when they confiscated an Orthodox church, the vessels and everything else, was handed over to the Jews, and they made a profit from it. There's high points and low points in the Polish and in the Cossack states. But by 1620, by the very act of these consecrations, anarchy was engulfing the Polish crown. The state was totally powerless against the oligarchy. The Cossacks turned to King Vladislav in 1647, begging him to protect the population from the oligarchy. He replied, essentially saying he has no power, but he said, "If you are brave Cossacks, defend yourself. You have sabers and you have strength." That was 1647, and that may have been the first act of the Khmelnytsky uprising. All of Little Russia rose up with him. It was, you know, one of the few times in history where a unanimous sentiment was put into action. The Ecumenical Patriarch, Constantinople, sent Khmelnytsky a sword with the understanding that he was the defender of the Orthodox faith. Now, in a few months, Khmelnytsky captured almost all of Little Russia, but couldn't resist the Polish counterattacks, and that's when he went to Moscow. The Moscow diplomats hesitated. They didn't want another war with Poland, but that's going to change later. But by the time Pereslav was concluded in 1654, Khmelnytsky had been reduced to the left bank, maybe with Kiev on the right bank. Under Moscow's protection, this part of Little Russia was inaccessible to the Poles, but became, it was quickly populated and flourished economically in every other way. The right bank, which was a nonstop battlefield, Cossacks, Poles, and Tartars, was largely deserted until all of Little Rus came under Great Russia, despite what was later done in the abuses of Peter and his successors. Well, to make a long story short, Khmelnytsky's rebellion fell apart because he had trusted the Crimean Khan and his Muslim infantry. Their treachery, you know, Khmelnytsky offered a certain amount of money, the Poles offered them more. And the result of all that was a sort of agreement with both Poland and the Crimea from 1649 to 1650. And this is what it stipulated. There are six things in particular. Cossack Ukraine was to include Kiev, Chernigov, and Bratslav. Those three areas was the core of the Hetmanate for many years. The second, in areas where the Ruthenians, Ukrainians, constitute a majority, in those areas only Orthodox people could hold office. The third, the unions were dissolved, and all their property is granted to the Orthodox churches. Number four, the Metropolitan ruling over the Orthodox of Ukraine was to have a guaranteed seat in the Polish Senate. Number five, a blanket amnesty for 1648. And finally, at least in Ukrainian lands, those three regions at its core, the Jews and Polish landlords will be prevented from returning. Those are the six stipulations of Zaborov concluded in 1650. That's just 2 years after the rebellion began. But as early as 1632, the Polish crown was fighting the oligarchy just like the Cossacks were. The Poles destroyed Ukrainian cities and imposed serfdom there after 1600. The 17th century had a landless rate of 40%, landless peasants. But just a few decades earlier, it was 10%. Magnates controlled at least 80% of the land within the Polish Empire. And that really didn't change much when the Russians took over. But it was a low point in Polish life, made worse by the partitions at the end of the 18th century. But at this point, Poland was isolated. Turkey, Moldova, Transylvania, Sweden all broke relations with her. Now, the Church of the Zaporozhian Host. We're talking roughly the period of 1734 to 1775 when it was destroyed. I had to consult Alexander Moisenkov in Russian, talking about the structure of the Orthodox Church within the Cossack elements. Of course, to be a Cossack, you had to be Orthodox. This was non-negotiable. Moisenkov says, yes, there was a specific church structure and culture. No military action from the Cossacks could occur without a blessing from the clergy. By 1734, Zaporozhye had four large parishes. Doesn't sound like much, four parishes, but these were huge. And the clergy was usually monastic. It comes from the Motrinitsky Monastery. And they all had to live outside of the stockade, of course. Clergy served only for a year. It was Patriarch Joachim made that come directly under the Ecumenical Patriarchate. Motrinitsky Monastery dedicated to the Transfiguration. And that served as a bulwark against interference from bishops. Bishops were generally distrusted. But that monastery was of immense significance. It was a Cossack monastery which converted many Jews and Muslims. Catherine the Great, of course, shut it down and destroyed the last vestiges of Cossack life a little while afterwards. But it's not as if the instability of the Cossacks was just from external defeat or pressure. It was also internal. The Cossacks had their own oligarchs. Nothing like the Polish ones. But the division that I mentioned at the beginning, as well as others, financial and otherwise, couldn't agree on much. The state where a structure existed wasn't necessarily defensible. The idea of shared power went out of fashion. But at least on the left bank, Russian governors gave the impression that the Russian state was no different from the Poles. Someone of great importance. I mentioned him briefly last week. I need to get into more detail here. This is a more or less pro-Polish hetman, head of the Cossacks, Ivan Verkhovsky, who looked to the Greek polis and Aristotle as the foundation for the Cossack host. He was famous, as I mentioned last week, in 1658 for the Hadyak Treaty, which he created. It was signed but never put into action. I think last week I said it was never signed. It was, but it didn't matter. Verkhovsky was vaguely, and I'm using that deliberately, vaguely pro-Polish, that it was a better option than Russia. And the Hadyak Treaty was to have a Ruthenian nation within the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. It was a trilateralist solution. Ukraine would be the third entity in the Polish-Lithuanian Union with a great degree of independence and religious freedom. As I mentioned, the Treaty of Pereslav was the opposite of Verkhovsky's treaty. But Pereslav agreed, or at least the negotiations of Pereslav with Russia, agreed to the majority of Ukrainian demands. Granting the Cossack state broad autonomy, a large Cossack register, and the maintenance of the Kievan Orthodox Metropolitan and his status. That would keep reporting to the Patriarch of Constantinople rather than Moscow. Now, like all of these agreements, the Hetman was prohibited from having his own foreign policy, especially relative to the Turks or the Poles. So now, at least on the left bank, the status of Ukraine was under Russia rather than Poland. But the Hadyak Treaty, or the Hadyak Treaty, depending on where you want to put the accent, was, as I mentioned in the beginning, the symbol of the pro-Polish faction among the Cossacks. Pereslav was the symbol of the pro-Russian. And the divisions were nasty. As I said last week, whenever one faction got too strong, the other one would rise up. This treaty was the cause of the pro-Russian revolt among the Cossacks. Bogdan Khmelnytsky's son, Yuri, was on the hapless side. He maintained a close relationship with the Poles, but then later on became a puppet hetman of the Turks. But Hadyak saw the Metropolitan of Kiev in the Polish Senate and all Protestants and heretics removed from the Ruthenian region. My reading of the treaty, and this is absolutely essential to understanding the political thought of the Cossacks at the time, I've come up with 15 separate items. Again, Chernigov, Bratislav, and Kiev. That's where the Grand Principality of Ruthenia, the duchy, was to be made out of. This would be part of a new trilateral commonwealth. The duchy was to be governed by the Zaporozhian hetman, and the procedure was there were four candidates presented by the Cossacks, and those candidates had to be chosen by all estates, all classes of Cossack society. He was elected for life, and the Polish monarch would choose one. Local offices staffed in the Polish manner would be staffed in the Polish manner. I don't know what that means. And there's not much on that particular item. But it does say, number four, law and the court system will be restored, and the administrative system that existed prior to the uprising will be revivified. Again, number five, no independent foreign policy. Number six, the Orthodox Metropolitan of Kiev and five of his suffragans were granted permanent seats in the Polish Senate. Number seven, the Ruthenian sector could coin its own money. It just had to have an image of the Polish king on it. The registry was, regular registry went up to 60,000 and 10,000 mercenaries. But number nine is the most interesting of this treaty. And I'm paraphrasing, but it restores the great landowners, it restores serfdom, and all obligatory duties existing prior to 1648. Now, I might not be reading that right, but that's what it looks like to me. But they kind of made up for that. Number 10, the old rights and privileges of the Cossacks would be restored, and up to 100 Cossacks from each regiment, and I don't know the time frame, I don't know if this is per year, were eligible to be ennobled by the King of Poland. And the Brest Union in 1596, the Unia was totally canceled. Number 12, Polish forces could not enter the territory of the duchy except for emergencies. Even when that happened, it would be under the hetman. 13, the Kiev Molia Academy was granted the same rights as the University of Krakow. 14, nationwide, that is to say throughout the empire, was permitted to establish colleges and lower schools teaching in the Latin language. And finally, there was a freedom of the press, specifically the religious press, guaranteed unless it was involved in caricature, mocking the Polish crown. It seems that this treaty, which is very interesting, which was the Hadyat Treaty of Hetman Wojciechowski after the uprising in the Polish areas, it seems like this treaty was signed with the Cossacks rather than Ukraine. Most of these are very vague, as you have probably gathered. Of course, none of them were ever implemented. The Russians found them intolerable, and the Polish oligarchy was divided on the issue. A year later, a new treaty with Russia was forced on the country. And that too, the Zhirdevsky article is a very obscure document. The Hetman, Mikhail Doroshenko, negotiated things like local autonomy, Russian truth being under the Hetman's authority, a unified Ukraine, the Orthodox Church under Constantinople. And this ultimately was rejected. It never came into force. But by 1665, the position of the Cossack host in Lower Russia was so poor that Moscow just thought it could do whatever it wanted, including impose high taxes. One of the pro-Russian hetmans, Ivan Rukovetsky, I think I mentioned this last week, that he had one demand, and that Ukrainian common law remain in force. And in exchange, all kinds of loyalty within the Orthodox Church promised to the Tsar and his interests. I also mentioned the Magdeburg Law in the cities. This really was a German development, making the cities, in a non-Jewish sense, autonomous. City offices were elected according to local tradition. The Hetman itself, too. This was promised by Russia over and over again, but it was to be violated the first opportunity. The Magdeburg Law was really the rise of the merchant class in Germany, regulating urban trade. And this did have something to do with the Jews, just not in the Polish sense. The Jews under this law had a special status, especially in Germany. Now, this didn't, any time the Magdeburg Law was established in a city, this doesn't necessarily come with it, and certainly that's going to be the case in Ukraine too. But in many of these merchant cities, Jews negotiated privileges. Generally speaking, they were only subject to the crown. And usually it comes down to maintaining their kahal system, living according to their own laws. And in the Magdeburg Law in Germany, and this is, I think, relatively well known, there was a provision where Jews could not be forced to give an account as to where their property comes from. Voluntarily, he could, but technically you couldn't force him, giving the Jews a tremendous advantage. Anyway, that's essentially the common law, at least in cities. And minus the Jewish question, that's pretty much what Rukovetsky asked for. Now, was it the smart thing to do to court Moscow? And he did make a convincing argument, far better than the Polish version. One of his arguments was that the Ottoman Empire was the enemy, even more so than Poland. Their empire was growing. They already had a foothold on the Black Sea, but they coveted far more than that. Ultimately, no side should be trusted, including their own side, as far as the Cossacks were concerned. Agreements made today will be nullified tomorrow, depending on the distribution of military strength. And when you're dealing with the Poles, if the crown issues a decree, it's usually overruled by the Szlachta. The oligarchy was the only power in the Polish Empire. That means without Russian infantry, Poles, Turks, and their Tartar allies, if they combine their forces, even to a small extent, could take Ukraine. The ruin, and this is what we mean by the ruin, this was given that name because there were so many rival claimants to the Hetman office, and the office in Ukraine itself was deeply divided physically and intellectually. But no matter what you might think, Russia alone could give the stability that Ukraine needed. This is a very rough neighborhood. Rukovetsky soon, though, was perceived as being dependent on Russian forces. Despite the promises, military units in Ukraine had free passage. In 1668, an uprising against the pro-Russian faction broke out. And these intense divisions and violence led to one of the most evil treaties of all time, the Treaty of Andrusovo in 1667. This is right up there with Versailles. The treaty was to negate everything the Cossacks had gained, and it divided the country between Poland in Russia. This is the ultimate betrayal. It handed over many Orthodox to Polish and Jewish usurers. Poland and Russia now were bound by treaty as equals and allies at the expense of the Cossacks. Obviously, at Andrusovo, no Cossacks were permitted at the negotiating table. Serfdom was implemented on both banks. This is the origin of the Western-Eastern Ukraine distinction. This was a huge insult. It condemned thousands of Orthodox Russians to torment and expropriation, especially on the Polish side. The entire Hetmanate was declared null and void. Part of the point was to destroy the Cossacks or render them never thinking of independence ever again. I think I said last week they had a free trade regime, which is just another way of saying the Polish and Jewish merchants will colonize the area. Massive interest rates and Jewish rules without any countervailing power, which is something that was not in Russia's interest. After Cossack independence was nullified by this treaty in 1672, the Konotop Articles then violated whatever promises had been made in the past and imposed an appointed hetman on Ukraine. These policies led to further division and further violence. Seaman Pali had his own revolt. Pali was very much a Sikh-style Zaporozhian. He played Poland against Russia, trying to use that rivalry for his own benefit. The man who defeated him was Ivan Mazepa. But on the other side, the 1658 Hajduk Treaty stipulated the Polish Senate had to have Orthodox people in it. I mean, it was the only Orthodox institution within the Federation. Could the Hajduk Treaty have created a new Ukrainian Orthodox identity with its own seminaries and everything else? And I've stated that it could have solved the old ritual problem, because it could have brought the old believers under the Ukrainian communion. But the poorer Cossacks hated Vyhovsky, and one uprising would exist at the expense of the other faction. But Andrusovo eliminated all of this. And just like Rukovetsky was seen as too pro-Russian, Vyhovsky was seen as too pro-Polish. But the wealthier Cossacks saw Poland as the lesser evil. They thought that Russia wanted to absorb the Cossack host into the empire. Vyhovsky was a talented man. He was a lawyer. He created the structures of the state, financial reserves, the balanced budget, and created the groundwork for functioning institutions. Another very pro-Polish hetman was Paul Teteria, who died in 1670. These tensions, again, this is what we mean by the phrase the ruin. Everything was negated. The victories of Ivan Serka, which I mentioned last week, Khmelnytsky, was negated. It also overthrew the Treaty of Hadyach, 1658, and that's the reason why it was never put into motion. Teteria, who worked for Khmelnytsky at one point, ruthlessly purged his officer corps, trying to create some unity out of this chaos. But this was typical of the ruin. In 1663, Teteria officially succeeded Khmelnytsky as the hetman of Ukraine, and then he began his purge. He couldn't handle this constant division anymore, and of course he handled it in the absolute wrong way. He had Vyhovsky executed. He had Ivan Bohun executed, who attempted a coup against him, imprisoned Yuri Khmelnytsky. And the closest Ukraine ever got to overcoming the ruin was a hetman by the name of Petro Doroshenko. He blamed the upper classes of the Cossack host on both banks, but especially the left, for the ruin. We're talking about depopulation here. Wanted to continue building a functional state. He even created a bicameral system, the Supreme Military Council, which was open to junior officers, and a Cossack parliament that was open to everybody, unlike the Polish legislature. He was extremely pro-Polish, and it irritated a lot of people. In 1664, he was with Jan Kazimir II, led an invasion into left bank Ukraine, trying to unify it, but the attack failed. He was unable to deal with social unrest, and he abdicated in 1665, fleeing to Poland. Whether or not he became Catholic is open to interpretation. I'm not sure. Russians accused him of that, but I don't know how true it is. Again, back to Peter Doroshenko. He initially was a right bank hetman. I think I mentioned last week that he created a bodyguard loyal to him to have a, almost like an opportunity, to have a force stronger than the wealthy. Hadyat was a dead letter. Doroshenko tended to be anti-Russian. And I, in fact, fought them on a regular basis. Semilovich was his left bank rival, which Russians helped elect, and wanted, and a war was brewing between the two. And actually, it was Teteria that promoted Doroshenko to his chief of staff in 1663, and he became the head of the senior officer corps. And he opposed the Pereslav Agreement, obviously. Doroshenko was supported by the Tartars and Ottoman Turkey. And with them as allies, this is one of the exceptions where it's neither Poland nor Russia, but Turkey. Doroshenko used them to crush the pro-Russian Cossacks on the left bank, or even the right bank too. He secured the right bank first, and then he invaded left bank Ukraine, like Teteria had done. And he supported an uprising of Ivan Bukovetsky against Russia. Now understand what's happening here. The Russians always overstepped, charging taxes, quartering troops, you know, even though they had agreed not to do this. I don't know if it's local commanders or what, but it was the worst way to handle this situation. Using the Turks, he took the right bank, the Polish side. But because the Russians had pushed so hard in the left bank, the normally pro-Russian Ivan Rukovetsky rose up and fought the Russians. And that's how Doroshenko, for the first time in a long time, was proclaimed the hetman of all Ukraine in June of 1668, one of the few times the entire country was unified. But all that means, now whatever you think about the Ottomans in this case, and they behave very badly, the minute he showed the way out of the ruin, he made enemies. The more powerful he became, the more enemies he made. There was a new Polish offensive against him, forcing him back to the right bank, Ukraine. The left bank, he appointed Damian Nohoreshny. The name actually means many, many sins. Doroshenko had the Metropolitan of Kiev, Joseph Tulaski, freed from captivity. And then he moved his seat to Trin. Council of Officers in 1668 said going to the Ottoman Turks makes some sense. They went to Constantinople to propose a military alliance. It was approved again in 1669 at the Korsun Cossack Council. And the alliance was proclaimed publicly by the Sultan, Mehmed IV, May 1st, 1669, and Doroshenko even received a Turkish title, Sancak Bey. But in the fall of 1668, Nohoreshny pledged his allegiance to Russia, and his election was confirmed. Many in the Zaporozhian sect opposed Doroshenko, and they elected their own hetman, Petro Sukhovi, who also secured support among the Tartars. He challenged Doroshenko, but he lost. And Serko was actually working for Doroshenko at the time, but not for long. In June 1669, Sukhovi was deposed. And that invitation to division was defeated. Nohoreshny was replaced by Semilovich in 1672. And by this point, going to the Turks for an alliance was a very bad idea. He lost the respect of his initially very loyal civilians because of his cooperation with the Turks. The Turks devastated the land. I mean, that's the alliance that allowed him to unify all of Ukraine, but the cost was extremely high. Just like all the others who have to go to one faction or another, or factions who have to go to one great power or another, the wars were nonstop, and Doroshenko was forced to rely increasingly on the Turks. Very unpopular. 1674, Semilovich was proclaimed the hetman of all Ukraine. Semilovich and the Russian Grigory Romanovsky launched an attack, an expedition against Doroshenko, and besieged his capital, Tchirin. The Grand Vizier, Kara Mustafa, eventually drove the Russians out, but it was too late. Doroshenko abdicated in 1675. 1676, Samolovich crossed the Dnieper with about 50,000 men and besieged Doroshenko's capital. He officially abdicated September 19, 1676. The Turks were still there, though. The common folk absolutely loathed them. No one, as far as I know, went to the Turks again. Although when Mazeppa was driven out, when Peter the Great was ruling Petersburg, they went to the Ottoman state. Using the Turks was both his victory and his undoing. The Turks and their vassals, the Crimean Tartars, broke every promise they made. And people were predicting this, but because he was a talented man, they thought that he could make it work. But when the Russians supported Samolovich, finally captured him and sent him into exile, the Ukrainian state was dead. But that also means that Turkey was now the main enemy, the list of pro-Russian Cossacks who ruled much of Ukraine at the time. Bukovetsky wanted the Russians to send a metropolitan to take over the moribund Ukrainian autocephalous. But in the same year that the Old Believers were anathematized, the Russians took over Ukrainian lands, and especially Kiev. The so-called Moscow Articles of 1665 gave total control of Ukraine to Russia. Now, I do want to note that Khmelnytsky also went to the Turks as a way to balance Poland. Khmelnytsky went everywhere, and this wasn't uncommon either. The alliances near the end of Khmelnytsky's reign were with Transylvania and Brandenburg, along with, by the way, Sweden and to a lesser extent, Turkey. So it was a conceptual possibility, at least. But even the pro-Moscow Bukovetsky broke with Moscow. He said the Zaporozhian hosts broke their allegiance. There were good reasons for doing so. Both the Muscovite and the Polish commissars negotiated peace. And that was Andrusovo. And they plundered all of Ukraine. In other words, even the most pro-Moscow of the Cossack rulers would eventually turn on Russia's heavy-handedness. Treaty after treaty they signed and violated. I'm not exactly one to criticize Tsarist Russia, but it was very badly handled. Jumping ahead a little bit, Ivan Mazepa, who fought Peter the Great, and I'm very sympathetic here, Mazepa wanted to build a distinctive Ukrainian culture by his concern with the Baroque, and hence an Orthodox nation that uses that aesthetic. Ukrainians still do. Got to remember, I wrote all of this before the war started. Keep in mind that nothing in Kiev right now is legitimate. It has nothing to do with Ukraine. It has nothing to do with Ukrainian nationalism. It has to do with using Ukraine against Russia. And there's precedent, clearly. But to have the Jews in power in Kiev is a completely separate thing. How dare these people point to the Cossacks when the Cossacks would have annihilated these people? Even Mazepa, later on, said the peace of Andrusovo was the worst possible nightmare for Ukraine. Both powers Poland and Russia exploited the country. And that's why, I mean, Turkey was out, and that's why Mazepa went to the Swedes. It was perfect, right? They were far away, and I would have done the same. Peter I was a lunatic. He had no respect for human life, and he had exhausted Ukraine to the breaking point. I can't get into that, but I've written substantially on it. But Ukraine became a part of the Russian Empire after Mazepa was driven out. And he really was the last rebel against Peter. But the idea, regardless of where you find it, whether left bank or right bank, Orthodoxy was to be maintained as the official religion. And basically, except near the very end, it was to be autocephalous. The pro-Polish side wanted Russians expelled, and a Cossack parliament founded. And this is a military council, not a legislature in the Western sense. You had both a nationalist and a decentralist constitution. Unfortunately, decentralization, Sabonoprovna, they had no luxury. They didn't have the luxury of having that sort of system. Mazepa, of course, had enemies. Skoropadzi, Daniel Apostol, fought him and wanted an alliance with Peter the Great. By now, of course, the Cossack host was demoralized. And it was just a matter of time before Ukraine was brought directly under the Russian Empire. And not much is really heard about them, except as on Russian campaigns. They became a unit of the Russian army. Class warfare, the arrogance of the elites on all sides, and these desperate alliances of Doroshenko and Mazepa destroyed any hope of Cossack independence. Back when I first wrote this, that the Treaty of Hadiach was the closest that the Ukrainian nation ever got to developing an autonomous and autocephalous Orthodox presence in Eastern and Central Europe. Ukrainian identity was forged in the battle against the Catholics, whether it be the Unia or the Roman Church in Poland. And so it became a matter of just basic understanding that Ukraine means Orthodox. The church in Kiev descended, as I said, from Theophanes III, prior to the destruction of Catherine the Great, had 22 dioceses, 20 male monasteries, and 12 convents. After Catherine the Great, so we're, 1799, Kiev had been reduced to 8 dioceses and a handful of clergy. And that's roughly before then. Prior to that, Catherine eliminated the Hetmanate, introduced serfdom upon a free people, and shut down hundreds of Orthodox churches. I mentioned earlier that the Zaporozhians had 4 huge parishes. Catherine took that to mean that, they weren't really Orthodox. They're secular. They don't have many churches. But few institutions are normal for a people like that. Upon taking office in Rostov, St. Arsen Matyevich said there were only a handful of priests in Ukraine. Because of this, the Uniates grew in power. They reached their height of 12 million people in 1771. Massive purging, institutional instability of the Kievan church, the attacks on it from Russia and to a lesser extent Poland, the relationship between the clergy and the people was declining. Anti-clerical groups coming from Poland formed. This is what happens when, St. Petersburg, or Moscow before it, staffs a church that it really has no close connection to. The clergy were seen as functionaries serving someone else, which was another blow to the prestige of the church in the area. These men were appointed from Petrograd, not elected. And of course, the Ukrainian tradition, actually the entire Orthodox tradition, especially that of the old believers, which harkens back to a much older age, had elected offices. The finally, last week, I summarized the Kuli Vashina, the Hedimak uprising. That just means Orthodox rebels. This was the last hurrah of the Cossacks, really, until the Russian Civil War. And this uprising occurred in 1768. As I said last week, after all of this, during the reign of Catherine the Great, years later, more than 100 years after the uprising of Khmelnytsky, the population in right bank Ukraine was in the same position it was before. Economic, political, religious, and national oppression within a now tottering Polish Commonwealth. This uprising became one of the reasons for the collapse of the Polish Empire. I mentioned what a confederation is. Confederation, a temporary institution, usually a military one, built by the cooperation of a few oligarchs. Now, the Bar Confederation initially wasn't aimed at Russia, but against the Polish king. At the time, Stanislaus Poniatowski. Not to mention having Russian troops in Poland. But the Bar Confederation then later, once the Polish crown used Russian troops against them, the Bar Confederation then took on a mission of fighting Russian influence. And anything seemed that might be seen to be pro-Russian was stamped out. And this is just prior to 1768 and the uprising. But it's possible that given, you know, technology was increasing, personal arrogance was increasing, especially when you're dealing with a dying empire like Poland at the time, serfdom was extremely harsh. Now, this has nothing to do with Polish culture. Polish culture can't help be affected by it, but it's not the origin of it. I don't make those arguments whatsoever. I also should note that these confederations were often so ignorant that they killed a lot of Uniates, a lot of Greek Catholics, because they didn't know the difference. They looked Orthodox to me. And Roman Catholicism was imposed. So the oligarchy created this confederation in 1768. And this was the military organization that issued reprisals against not just the Orthodox, but Uniates too. Again, they didn't know the difference. And it was the actions of the Bar Confederation that led to the uprising in 1768 under the Zaporozhian Cossack, Maxim Zeliznyak. I think I mentioned last week it started off with 18 people, and it engulfed almost the entire right bank. Local peasants, deserting soldiers from Russia, merchants, everyone else. The rebels kind of assumed that because they were at war with Poland and they were Orthodox, they would get help from the Russian government. I mean, they want to weaken Poland, right? It didn't happen. Yes, the Lisniak and even Gonta, their uprising was systematic. I think last week I mentioned the Golden Charter of Catherine the Great, which allegedly permitted the extermination of Poles and Jews. But of course, that was a fiction. It didn't exist. But the fact that people believed it showed just how desperate people were to find some Russian connection. This suggests a strong current of pro-Russian thinking based on orthodoxy. Didn't say anything about a golden charter from the Polish king or the Swedish. It was Catherine the Great. This golden charter, although a fiction, galvanized this Hedimak movement. It took most of right bank Ukraine, Kiev, Bratslav, Podolia, Volyn, even Galicia. But it was Russians that crushed the uprising. The Polish army assisted it. Confederation army, left bank Ukraine, a little bit. Even Zaporozhye, even Gonta and Zeliznyak were arrested in July 7th, handed over to the Polish authorities. And this was a betrayal that was almost frightening. The naive assumption was that the Russians were going to help us against Polish serfdom and Jewish control, and nothing of the kind happened. Zeliznyak and his friends were tortured to death. Actually, Zalesniak, his final resting place, isn't known after 1770. Many of these people were sentenced to hard labor. Even you had plenty of clergy, like Bishop Gorevasi of Pereslav, was critical of this uprising, called on the Orthodox to not participate in it, not so much because they didn't have a just cause, but mostly because there was no chance of them winning. Didn't matter. The Polish Confederations blamed all of these people for the unrest in Ukraine. It doesn't make any difference. There were other confederations, the Slutsk Confederation, the Toron Confederation, all oligarchic. And Catherine II was like an animal against the Russian Orthodox and Cossacks, who rose up against Polish control on the right bank. A lot of bishops were moved around. Gorevasi was, even though he wasn't even on the right bank at the time. He didn't want the Orthodox people to be a part of this. It's impossible. Even the great Melchizedek, who's now a saint, the abbot of the monastery I've already mentioned, Motroninsky Monastery, which was another Cossack one. And but there is one good thing. I know I've gone on very long here. I don't really care that much. But one of the great things here, I mentioned that the Uniates grew in power. But after the bravery of the Hadimak Rebellion, this and the viciousness of the Polish and even Russian response, the Greek Catholic Metropolitan of Kiev, Philip Volokovich, who was a persecutor of Orthodoxy, was eventually removed by the Confederation because he became an Orthodox Russophile. And he said that the Uniates are ready to convert. And in Russian areas, the Uniates were brought over to Orthodoxy, many of them not realizing that they weren't a part of Orthodoxy, especially since the Poles were killing them anyway, not knowing the difference between a Uniate and an Orthodox clergyman. But by the death of Catherine, over 1,200 parishes became Orthodox. So these things can change very, very quickly. Now, I know that this is very difficult. I know that this gets very chaotic, but it's reflective of the time and the circumstances. I hope I clarified all of these things, or some repeat from last week, but I hope this makes more sense to you than it did a week ago. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.